This morning, we're standing at a crossroads a little bit in our work in the story. And obviously, we're going to be taking a break for a couple of weeks for being up at the retreat and then being, you know, focusing on Easter, focusing on the resurrection on Easter Sunday. And we'll be coming back in a couple of weeks. But this is a major transition because up until this point, God has been preparing his people. He has been getting them ready to be everything that he intended them to be. And throughout, you know, bringing them out of Egypt and the promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and then the promise that's fulfilled through Moses and bringing them out of Egypt and bringing them into the land through Joshua and through the time of the judges and trying to get them established into their identity and to stop forgetting who they are and remember who they are and keep remembering who they are as God's people. And then the kings, the rising up of Saul that doesn't work so well, and the rising up of David that works much better, but then there's some stumbling blocks. And now we are sitting at his son, David's son, Solomon. And it's a time where God has finished preparing his people. They have everything that they need in order to be what God has called them to be, which in essence is exactly that chorus that out of Israel would resound to the nations of the earth, lift up his name with the sound of singing. Lift up his name in all the earth. Lift up your voice and give him glory, for he is worthy to be praised. That would be the reason for Israel to exist. But it can go one of two ways in Israel. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, is that it could go one of two ways. Having four kids in our household, we are intimately familiar with the great masters of poetry and prose. You know who I'm talking about, right? Shel Silverstein, Beatrix Potter, Eric Carle. That's a Hungry Caterpillar guy, in case you're wondering who that was. E.B. White, Charlotte's Web, and of course, one Theodore Geisel, who you might better know as Dr. Seuss, perennial favorite of ours. And you know, there's nothing quite as sublime as the rhymes of his that roll off your tongue. You know, one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish, black fish, blue fish, old fish, new fish. This one has a little car. This one has a little star. My, what a lot of fish there are. You know, I mean, it's just great. You can just go, right? You can just go. But I love our guy Ted. He is such a wise individual, though. I love the wisdom that is packed into his little stories. You know, the kids come back for the funny pictures and the kooky rhymes, but I love him for the wisdom. You learn about persistence. You learn about the importance of trying new things in green eggs and ham. You learn about the dangers of materialism and cliquishness in the Sneetches. You learn about you even learn a bit about the dangers of fascism in Yertle the Turtle. You know, learn about the importance of sustainable resources in the Lorax. I mean, you can go on and on, right? And you also learn about rare animals like the Bippo Nobungus, which I have found that you are supposed to capture in the land of Hippo Nohungus, because those are better than the ones in Dippo Nodungus, and they're smarter than the ones in Nippo Nonungus. So you better grab your bungus from Hungus rather than Dungus or Nungus. Common wisdom, right? I worked on that all day Friday. Oh, man. That's in If I Ran the Zoo, by the way, which is also a very good book, which just more teaches you all kinds of cool names like seersuckers and nerds and things. They're actual animals, which is cool. But in light of what we're talking about this morning, I thought we would turn to a lesser known work of Dr. Seuss, which is simply titled The Zode in the Road. And it goes like this. Did I ever tell you about the young Zode who sat at a sign at the fork in the road? And he looked one way and the other way too, and the Zode had to make up his mind what to do. So the Zode scratched his head and his chin and his pants and said to himself, well, I'll be taking a chance. If I go to place one, well, it may be hot, and how will I know if I like it or not? On the other hand, though, I will feel such a fool if I go to place two and I find out that it's cool. If that is the case, I may catch a chill and turn blue. So place one may be best and not place two. I'll play safe, cried the Zode. Play safe, that's what I'll do. I'll simply start off. Because I'm no dunce, I'll simply start off and go both places at once. And that's how the Zode, who would not take a chance, went nowhere at all with a split in his pants. Great little story, right? Like I said, we come to a major turning point between Israel and God. And God is preparing his people to be a light to the nations, to be a restorative agent between God and humanity. And all of these promises are finding their fulfillment. And even though there have been bumps in the road, now Israel is ready to finally not just embrace, but to actually own their role in the world. But the question is, will they? And that's the two roads that stand before Israel and its king. The beloved son of the formerly scandalous union between David and Bathsheba, Solomon, is now the established king. Which road gets taken is greatly going to impact the path of both the lower story of Israel and the upper story of what God is trying to do and his plans for redemption. And so we stand at this great fork in the road, and it involves Solomon and his kingship. As David passes the leadership baton to Solomon at the beginning of the history narrative of 1 Kings, there are all the things that we would expect from any kind of power exchange. There are claims to the throne that need to be sorted out. There's power consolidation, and these things are told as fact, kind of grisly fact. As we kind of said in class this morning, it's kind of anarchistic. It happens really fast and kind of crazy, and you're like, whoa, okay, and this person's dying, and that person's dying, and this person's making a claim to the throne, and they're getting put down, and everything's kind of crazy. And then in the middle of all this comes chapter 3, and it just kind of rises up out of the seemingly craziness of the establishment of Solomon's reign. It says, just remember, like, God's in control of all of this. Just remember, God is the one that's anointing Solomon. Just remember, God is the one that's in charge of all of this mess. As though to kind of remind us, because otherwise Solomon's rise to power really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But in that securing of the throne, we run into this huge change in the story in chapter 3. And after Solomon offers these numerous sacrifices at this place called Gibeon, his anointing as king is confirmed in this idea that, like his father David, God initiates communication with him as his chosen representative. And God initiates relationship with him in a very, very special way as his chosen representative. And in this vision, God lays out this truly wondrous question to Solomon. What do you really want in your kingship? What do you really want your kingship to be about? Ask, and I'll give it to you. Just think about that question for a second. I mean, we tell God what we would like all the time, right? But what if God came to you and said, what do you really want your life to be about? Go ahead and ask, I'll give it to you. How long would you have to think about that? Would you be stuck for a long time? Would you know right off the bat exactly what your answer would be? I don't know. I might have an answer right away, and then I would have to kind of like stuff it back in my mouth and think a little bit. And I don't know. The story doesn't tell us how long it takes for Solomon to weigh in with his answer. But when he does, when he gives his answer, it is both a surprising and a very, very faith-filled answer. It's a very humble answer, actually. He asks for wisdom, saying, you know what, there's all this already in my kingship, there's all this craziness going on, and I'm not really sure that I'm going to be able to be the king that I'm supposed to be if I don't have your wisdom. Your wisdom and your character need to guide me. And this isn't just any kind of wisdom Solomon's asking for, okay? He is not asking to be able to have all the answers to every Jeopardy episode ever, okay? Like, that's not what we're talking about, okay? You know, right answers for 500, Alex. You know, like, that is not what he is asking for. He is also not asking for the ability to be prophetic or read minds or get ahead of people or something like that. That's not what he's asking for. The phrases that he uses in chapter 3, verse 9 are very significant. And they really, really outline that Solomon is asking for more of a relationship than just a gift. When Solomon asks for a discerning heart in verse 9, the phrase literally means, and I love this, a heart that knows how to hear. A heart that hears. And what I love about that is that it makes wisdom and discernment relational. Solomon isn't just asking to be able to make the right choices. He isn't asking to be infallible in his thinking. What he's asking for is the ability to move in step with God's spirit of wisdom. That's what he's asking for. Give me a heart that can actually hear the language that you're speaking, that can actually hear the direction that you're going, so that I can follow it. See, discernment for the follower of God, for you and I as well, is rooted in the ability to hear God's prompting in his spirit and to hear his leading in the midst of the noise that surrounds our life. It's the ability to be able to isolate and identify and hone in on the frequency of God's voice and his path. That's what discernment really is. That's what a heart that hears is all about. And Solomon also asks in verse 9 for an ability to distinguish between right and wrong. But it's not for its own benefit. It is ability to distinguish between right and wrong for the express purpose of being able to govern the people of Israel as a king should. And I think that's a really important, there's a really, really important undercurrent in both of these requests, okay, is that the end goal is not for Solomon to have the best life ever. And I think that's really important, because I think that I would have to confess that if God posed this question to me, even if I was asking for good things, not just wealth, not just whatever, even if I was asking for a good thing, I might be tempted to ask for things with the ultimate end goal of making my life better. And assuming, oh, God is blessing me, that must mean that he wants my life to be better. That was the reason that he's blessing me. And it's really important to realize that when Solomon asks these things, it is not, the undercurrent is not to make my life better. The undercurrent is so that I may embrace the fullness of the identity that you have for me as king. And I think for us, when we receive blessing, the question that we need to ask is, why is that blessing coming? Is it coming just to make my life better, or is it coming so that I can more fully embrace the identity of who God is asking me to be? There's another, you know, there's a purpose there. There's a reason there for the blessings that God gives. It's so significant because I think there's a real push in the culture of modern Christianity to desire holiness for self's sake. You know, get right with God because it's going to make your life better. And you know what? I agree with that to an extent. I believe that when we are seeking and pursuing the things of God, our lives will be better. But that's not the point. The fact that our lives will be better is a side thing. That's not the main event. We pursue holiness for the sake of lift up his name and give him glory, for he is worthy to be praised. Lift up his name in all the earth, so that is a beacon shining out of our lives. And that anything that enhances our life or anything that makes our life better is merely so that we have more evidence to point and say, see what I'm saying? Lift up his name. And you know, lift up his name. We cannot skip that end goal. We cannot stop before the fact that the reason that we are empowered with the Spirit, or the fact that we are given blessing, or that we are given gifts of the Spirit, or that we are given anything, is for the express purpose of the glorification of God. You cannot untie those two things. And yet sometimes I think we're very, very good at untying those two things. And the battle for Solomon is going to be, can I keep those two things tied together? The writings of Solomon in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, which is something that we're going to get more into in our summer series. We're going to be doing a series on the wisdom books throughout the summer. There is equal evidence to show that sometimes being righteous equals gaining security and peace, and sometimes being righteous has absolutely no bearing on our security or our peace whatsoever. It's quite the opposite. Actually, sometimes being righteous means an absence of security and peace. And it's okay. In fact, it's supposed to be that way. It's all right. But the follower of God seeks and embraces righteousness for only one reason, is that it helps them fully embrace that identity as God's follower. And it positions them to act out their calling in the most effective way possible. Just like Solomon, we have to seek wisdom and be wise so that we can govern our kingdoms as well. because we aren't actually the ruler. We are just the embodiment of the great ruler, right? We're the embodiment and the character of the true ruler. Whether our kingdom is our household, whether our kingdom is our workplace, wherever our kingdom may be, all we are is the representative, the embodiment, the representative, right? That's what our role is as followers of Jesus, as disciples. And that's why we need to seek wisdom. And that's why Solomon's answer is so good. Not just because it's not the wealth and the security and the, you know, lack of problems, because he doesn't seek those things that that others might seek. It's why he seeks what he seeks. And God responds to both of these requests in a very, very surprising way. He grants the wisdom one. He grants the heart that hears. He grants the discernment. He grants all those things. Plus, he also throws in the other stuff, which is confusing sometimes, because you look at Solomon's life and you go like, well, yeah, but if by granting some of these things, he actually makes Solomon's life more difficult and burdens Solomon's heart and even kind of dulls Solomon's heart a little bit, why give it to him in the first place? And well, the key is will you maintain the relationship? Will you maintain the relationship of wisdom? You say you want a heart that hears, but will you, can have a heart that hears, but will you actually put into practice what you hear? Right? I mean, it's the same thing for us. James says, don't just be hearers. You can have a heart that hears all day long. The question is when you hear, do you do? Or do you just kind of fool yourself with like, oh yeah, I heard that. I get that. All right. Thank you, God. Heard it. Message received. Okay. Does it go into practice? And that's going to be the real question for Solomon. And that's going to be the real question for Israel. They are being given a heart that hears. They're being given this great gift. But will they do? Will they embrace it and actually live it? Will they take it to the next step and take the wisdom that they've received and use it to enact that identity, to bring about the glory of God? That's where the two roads of possible kingship are for Solomon, and the two roads of the future of the kingdom of Israel begin to kind of emerge. On the one hand, you have the path that Solomon initially chooses to embody the qualities of Deuteronomy 17, the king who rules justly, who loves mercy, who is devoted to God, and who does not set himself above his people. On the other hand, while riches, peace, and long life are not necessarily bad things to ask for, they are the trappings and the glory of a royal ideology that isn't necessarily consistent with God's identity for the king. God makes it pretty clear that these gifts of wealth and peace and long life and unity of the northern and southern tribes of Israel under one throne are conditional on the adherence of Solomon to God's pattern for a king. In one sense, you can have both, says God, but you can't pursue both. You can't take both roads. These trappings have to come solely as gifts from Yahweh, not from the striving of the king or the development of an empire. And there's a significant tension there for Solomon, something that's really going to test the limits of that wisdom and discernment that he's been given. How does the king who has it all keep his focus on that one thing, being an effective representative of Yahweh? It's the same struggle that his father David had, just in a little bit different way. So throughout the bulk of the story of Solomon, he seems to do a fairly good job of being a pious and just leader. But there are hints all the way through that the identity that he embraces and the wisdom that is bestowed, they are not always applied as unilaterally to Solomon himself as they are applied to other people. It is interesting to see, and we were talking about this in class this morning, that while the narrator, the one who writes 1 Kings, is definitely playing safe because he's dealing with Solomon, one of the most respected kings in the history of Israel, he is not afraid, the writer is not afraid to bring in these little things that show that when it comes to that identity of Deuteronomy 17, which specifically says things like, don't build up your own military might. Trust God to fight your battles. Don't start looking like the Egypt that I brought you out of. Don't start being that empire. You're not here to build an empire. You're here to be my light. Let me build your dynasty. Don't build your own dynasty. Starts acquiring horses. Starts acquiring military might. Starts creating military forward bases to protect his wealth. Starts making, don't have lots of wives. Yeah. I don't want to tell you about that one. But one of the things that we brought up is not just don't have a lot of wives because you're a man. You can barely handle one. So, you know, okay. Not just for that reason, but why do kings make lots of marriages? Diplomatic alliances. For political reasons. Don't play the Game of Thrones, man. Stay out of that business. Let me rule. And you just kind of start looking and you start ticking through all of these little things in the narrative, and you find out that while Solomon is very, very good at embracing part of his identity that requires him to be the just and merciful king, he is also very much building an empire that looks like Egypt. And you see that tension just begin to widen as the narratives, you know, keeps going, right? And how is it going to end? Because there becomes a tension where you're getting stretched both directions, and you cannot continue. You can only stretch for so long and keep one hand here and one hand there when they're going different directions. Even from the very, very beginning, when you see Solomon wed the Egyptian princess to strengthen his diplomatic ties and secure his throne, it may be a politically savvy move, but there's a lot of foreshadowing even in that very, very first move that it's going to create a lot of problems in the future, because when you're tied to Egypt, you'll start to look like Egypt. And this is the God who frees slaves, not the God who makes slaves. And yet we find slaves building the temple of the Lord. Ouch. And this puts God in an awkward position, I think. What do you do when your nation starts not to look like you? Your, in essence, your body at that point in time starts to not really look very, very much like you. What do you do? And so even at the consecration of the temple, God has something very, very interesting to say to Solomon about where this can go. And he makes it real clear. This can go one of two ways. This can either go well with you, or it can turn sideways real, real quick. So there's this massive consecration ceremony for the temple, and it's capped off by this formal orative prayer of Solomon, inviting God to come and rest in his house. And the account of Scripture is this fantastic image of God's Spirit making itself manifest and physical and moving into the temple as this cloud of smoke and fire that and light that actually has weight, and so much weight and so much presence that it literally pushes the worshipers, pushes the priests out of the temple. I cannot even imagine what that would be like. For the glory of God to be so manifest in a particular place that I cannot even move against it. I can't even like wade into it. It is so thick and so real. Okay? Oh, fantastic, right? I love it. And Solomon and all Israel have to be thinking at that point, We're set. We're united, we're strong, and we have the Lord of hosts dwelling in the center of our city on Mount Zion. We're set. We have arrived. And it's at that point, and the key is at the beginning of chapter 9, where it says, and when Solomon had built the temple and had done all that he set out to do. Remember when that break came for David? He's set. He's not striving anymore. He doesn't have to strive. And he has the ability to either keep striving or say, I have arrived. Hey, guess what? It's that crucial point for Solomon right here. Okay, chapter 9. And God comes to him and says, look, I love the house. Okay, it's a great house. Love it. I'm going to dwell in it. And the unconditional promises, and my eyes will, and my heart will always be set toward this thing, because I know what it means, not just to you, but to me, okay? And realize that it's not the building, and it's not even what the building represents to Israel that's got God saying, making this unconditional promise of my eyes and my heart will always be set to it. It's what it represents to God, what he's always wanted from the beginning, which is that the divine and the human might coexist together. That humanity and their God might exist in good relationship. That's been God's desire from the beginning. And so he says, of course I will turn my eyes and my heart to it, because it is what I've always wanted. is to live among you and to live with you and to have my presence be here with you. And to be able to, in essence, you know, as even all the way back to Genesis 6, have my presence contend with you. It's what I've always wanted. But then everything moves from being unconditional to conditional. God offers a conditional promise in chapter 9 and this sobering warning to Solomon and, by extension, the rest of Israel. It's much like the blessings and curses, life and death choice that Moses and Joshua make back when Israel enter into the land. There are two roads, one in which the king and the nation embrace who they were meant to be, and they live for the glory of the Lord, and they rest in his favor and his presence. And then there's another road in which they will forget God, they will begin to live for their own glory, and things will go south from there. The language is really graphic here. It's much like the language that Jesus would recall in the Gospels about this magnificent dwelling place of God that's really imposing, and the disciples going, have you ever seen anything like this? And Jesus is like, hey, if my Father's not being glorified, you can almost guarantee that there's going to come a time not too long where you're not even going to be able to see one stone stacked on top of the other. It's going to be that desolate, and people are going to go, why has this happened? And the answer, because you started thinking that this was all about you, Israel. Because you started thinking that somehow Messiah meant being the big empire on the block and having everything that you ever wanted and having security and prosperity and peace, and that was what this is all about. You started thinking it was all about you, Israel, and it's never been about you. The only reason you exist in the way that you exist, Israel, is because I'm trying to let the world know that I exist, and I'm trying to use you. It's interesting how Jesus comes back to the exact same thing, the exact same fork in the road that God highlights to Solomon here. And this narrative of God also gets backed up by some prophetic words from the Queen of Sheba. If you look in chapter 10, she comes and she sees all of Solomon's glory. And while her speech to him in chapter 10, verses 6 through 9, it is just slathered in royal flattery. How happy everybody in your kingdom must be, and da-da-da, even the slaves who are doing forced labor to build the temple, you know. They must be happy slaves. You know, yes, there's a whole lot of buttering up in there, but then there's some real prophetic wisdom right in the middle of it. Praise be to God, she says, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's great love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness. She did not say, because of the Lord's great love for Israel, he has made you king, and you are maintaining justice and righteousness. Solomon isn't necessarily maintaining justice and righteousness at this point. He's actually making forward military bases and consolidating wealth and conscripting labor and even creating slavery and all kinds of things, right? No. It's prophetic in saying, look, even me from the outside, even me from Sheba, and the word is full of this, right? The world is full of people from the outside getting what God is about and people from the inside not getting what God is about. And this is just another example where she says, you know, there's only one reason I can think of why God has just poured all this all over you, this wealth and political success and diplomatic success and economic success and everything. There's only one reason. It is in order to maintain justice and righteousness, not even just among yourself, but among the nations. You got to read between the lines. Solomon, she says, none of this is really about you. None of this is really about you. This is all about you living in the favor of God. And he's expressing that favor to you by letting your kingdom be a place where he rules. And it's all conditional on you continuing to let the kingdom be a place where he rules. Unfortunately, that's not going to be the case as time goes by. the latter part of Solomon's rule is punctuated by a lack of justice and righteousness. We already see it kind of coming in as the empire is being built. And then finally, as his splendor increases, so do the taxes, and the mighty military requires more upkeep and more gold to make it run, and the people actually begin to groan under the prosperity of the king, and the seeds of rebellion are being sown by his own officials, especially one head foreman in architecture, a man named Jeroboam. And eventually that's going to become a split that takes the 10 northern tribes away and leaves Judah and Benjamin. All right? It's already being sown as Solomon gets stretched further and further as he's trying to walk two roads. But the real point at which we know that, like Dr. Seuss's Zode, Solomon is really trying to walk both paths, as we see in the relationship with his wives. And this is interesting, like I said, all 700 of them. And 300 concubines, which is just another fancy royal word for saying kind of other wives, kind of. Okay. 1,000. Okay. 1,000. Is it that they went down the lines and said, we've counted them all up and there's exactly 1,000? Or is it, we said, or is it more just saying, like, you have all the diplomatic and relational success you could ever, I mean, more than anybody ever could have even comprehended of. And yet what it's doing is dulling you down. And yet what it's doing is dulling you down. And you might think that in and of itself that the number is the focal sin, but the Bible seems less concerned with the number and more focused on what the influence is. By marrying outside of Israel to negotiate and secure influence, Solomon has opened up the door to a completely different kind of influence, a new breed of syncretism in Israel that's starting through Solomon's own worship, where he still holds Yahweh as above all, but not God alone. And that's a very subtle but very deadly, dangerous shift, is when God is allowed to be above many, but not alone. And I think there's a reason he ties it to the wives thing. Because it's like a man having a wife that he's married to and having a bunch of mistresses on his side. And saying, well, none of them are my wife, though. I mean, I only have one wife, right? Only got one. I mean, I only have one wife. And I have a whole lot of concubines that are, like, kind of sort of, but they're not my wife, right? Above all is not the same as alone. And that shift is going to start messing with Israel. In a big, big, big way. A little incense to Ashtoreth, a little sacrifice to Chemosh, some concessions to Molech, a little bit over here to Dagon. Just, you know, just to please the wives, make sure all of our bases are covered, right? I mean, we're still keeping Yahweh above all of them, right? We have the temple. We didn't build a temple to Molech. We didn't build a temple to Ashtoreth. We're still keeping God above all, right? And it just starts trickling downward, and as goes the king, so goes the nation. And ultimately, it's going to be the downfall of the United Kingdom. That promise to David about a line of succession is going to remain because of God's faithfulness, but the unity of the tribes is not. And now the focus shifts, because now God, who has been preparing his people to be a nation devoted only to him, is now going to have to shift his focus, because now instead of preparing his people, God will now begin pursuing his people. As when it really, really comes down to it and they are stretched thin between the two roads, they snap back to the road of idolatry rather than the road of devotion. And king after king, they're going to keep switching. We're going to see that here in a few weeks. They're going to keep switching between these two roads, between the road of devotion and the road of idolatry, and the road of devotion and the road of idolatry, and ultimately they will go nowhere. And they'll split the kingdom in two. Not just physically, but also in their loyalty to God. See, the most prevalent question that the story of Solomon puts in front of us is this: how do we respond to God's blessing? Salma has great intentions at the beginning. He understands the ideal. He understands the identity that he's called to live out of. But over time, he has the inability to appropriately respond to God's blessing. And that diverts his attention. And somewhere he starts thinking that the blessings are for his sake rather than God's. And from there, it's only a short step to thinking that kingship is really about him rather than the one whom he represents. And I think the same thing can happen to us. With prosperity and the blessing of God always come two roads. The one where we embrace the right identity and mission, where we live out the blessings that God intended, and the other where we get to think in that the story and the blessings and all of the trappings are all about us. And we abandon our identity for the sake of the blessing. I think for us as Christians, though, I believe the greater temptation is like Solomon, we think that we could have it both ways. That we can travel down the road of devotion and the road of self-interest at the same time, that we can keep God above all but not alone. And it splits us down the middle as surely as it does Solomon's identity and Solomon's kingdom. We cannot travel the road of self-interest and the road of devotion at the same time. We can let devotion turn our self-interest into God. We can have both. You know, I mean, Jesus made all of these claims. We're like, you know, ask for anything that you want in my Father's will, and he will surely give it to you. Those are sound promises. But the point is it's when your self-interest has been brought underneath so that it is God alone. Not Yahweh above all, but I'm also traveling the road of self-interest. Those two don't work together. You can have both. You can't pursue both. And also, I think like Solomon, our kingdoms will bear the brunt of our compromises when we choose to travel both roads. Our friends, our families, our marriages, our finances, these are things that God has given to us to govern. To follow, you know, to govern along this path that he has us embark on. And especially the path of syncretism, if we choose to go on that path where we give God lip service and then spend our time looking out for our own, it is our kingdoms that suffer. As goes the king, so goes the nation. Whatever your nation is, whatever God's given you to govern. And the solution, Jesus says, seek first the kingdom of the Lord and his righteousness, and let him take care of the rest. That's something that we must constantly wrestle toward and strive toward and surrender ourselves to. That none of this is really about us anyway. We exist for the identity of bringing God glory, and that is what truly brings purpose and focus to our life. One of the great lessons in Solomon for us is the difference between having wisdom and applying wisdom, I think. If the knowledge of God never becomes practice for us, if it never really becomes solid in our lives, it never really becomes anything if it just stays in the realm of theory. I got to speak this week with a bunch of ministers and pastors and preachers and priests from the greater Victoria area, and it was a great conversation about learning how to live in rhythm with God, about keeping in step with the Spirit from that verse in Galatians 5:25 that's always fascinated me. And in the message, Peterson translates this idea of being in step with God's Spirit like this. Since this is the kind of life that we have chosen, the life of the Spirit, let us make sure that we do not just hold it as an idea in our heads or a sentiment in our hearts, but we let it work out its implications in every detail of our lives. I think that was what Solomon was really praying for when he asked God for wisdom, the ability to listen, but the ability to incorporate the work of the Spirit in every detail of who he was so that he could really be God's man. Really be God's representative. And God was willing to give it to him freely. And I think God's willing to give that to you and me freely. This week, I really want you to consider this. How are those two paths playing out in your life? That path of devotion and that path of self-interest and idolatry. What parts of your life are on that one path of devotion? What parts of your life may be straining toward the other path? How is that tension working in your life right now? Are you feeling pulled? Are you feeling stretched thin because you're trying to play it both ways? God never intended you to live that way. I pray that God is going to freely give us wisdom to see the Spirit's desire for our lives, But even more, I pray that as we get ready and prepare ourselves to come to the table now, we will begin to act on that, that we will choose the path of devotion again, that we will let him work out the implications of his Spirit in the details of our life again. It is not meant to be a thought in your head or a sentiment in your heart. It is meant to incorporate into your very being. It is meant to move you. And so my prayer is that God will move you as we devote ourselves in worship and in prayer and the communion of the bread and the cup and in the whole of our lives. I pray that he will live and he will move in you, move you to the road of devotion, because that's the only road worth traveling. Let's stand and worship together.